Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on Thursday, the 18th of August, the year 2011. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll talk to Rick Trostle and friends about tomorrow's pirate-themed concerts by the Juneau Student Symphony. We'll also find out about the Valley Library's 39 Clues party this Saturday. And Ed Schoenfeld will be interviewing NPR's Peter Kenyon prior to Peter's talk before the Juneau World Affairs Council tonight at 5 at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center. That is today at 3 here on KTOO News. The forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies with isolated showers in the evening, then chance of rain later on, low temperatures around 50 degrees. Forecast for Friday looks like rain with high temperatures around 57 degrees. Saturday looks like rain, possibly heavy at times.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Rosebud Sioux Tribe of South Dakota is beginning work on a cemetery to honor Native veterans. As South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports, it's the first of its kind in the United States.
Earlier this year, the Rosebud Sioux Tribe applied for a grant to develop a Native veterans cemetery on tribal land. The closest national cemetery to the Rosebud Reservation is about 200 miles away near Sturgis. This week, South Dakota U.S. Senator Tim Johnson announced the Veterans Administration will grant the tribe $6.8 million for the concept. Johnson says the project is the first of its kind developed jointly by the VA and a tribe. Plans call for an 80-acre cemetery near the intersection of U.S. Highways 18 and 83. Native veterans, their spouses, and dependents would be eligible for burial there. The tribe will be responsible for upkeep of the cemetery. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
A Navajo code talker shares his stories about serving in World War II. Samuel So was among the Navajo men who used an unbreakable military code which was developed in their language. So, from Lukachukai, Arizona, joined the Marines at 18. He says he was attached to a recon company and sent to Iwo Jima to blow up obstacles on a beach. They went in by submarine and surfaced about 2 miles off Iwo Jima and used rubber boats to ride to the beach.
There's a guy by the name of Al Mertz. He's an underwater demolition expert. He was with us. And he searched all over the place. We searched all over the place. We didn't find any obstacle.
So says they decided to go back using the rubber boats, but the current prevented them from doing so. And after repeated attempts, the Japanese showed up. He says the military sent in gunboats, which the Japanese sunk. So speedboats were used to get the men to safety.
They put on a speedboat with ropes and inner tube tied to it. When the speedboat comes around, we just have to grab that inner tube and hang on for our lives. What they did was they just pulled us out of the way of the Japanese gun range. They just took us off the gun range and released us back to the ship.
So says he believes he was one of the first Navajos to set foot on Iwo Jima.
But they send me back where the ships are coming in, and here I have to come back with the ship and then land on Iwo Jima Beach, right underneath Mount Suribachi. And I don't know whether if I'm the first one to step off and set foot on Iwo Jima first or not. But I still say that. But there's a lot of Anglo kids says, no, we're the one. Oh, yes, I was the one that rolled you into the island.
He shared his memories last week in Gallup, New Mexico. The events he talked about happened in March of 1945. The Alaska Native Callista Corporation says it sold the last two of its six weekly newspapers. According to the Associated Press, the corporation said Wednesday it's selling the Tundra Drums and the Seward Phoenix Log to an associate professor at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. Callista announced last month it was closing its chain of six weeklies due to rising costs. During this month in 1970, about two dozen Native people occupied Mount Rushmore in South Dakota. They camped out for 3 months to draw attention to Native issues like sovereignty, treaty rights, and poverty. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
There's some good pirate music getting all ready for the Juno Student Symphony's performance of pirate music coming up tomorrow at noon at the State Office Building and at 7 o'clock at the Zach Gordon Youth Center. In the studio with me now are Rick Trostel, the director of the symphony, and also Jaden, Jillian, and Dugan. Thank you very much for coming to the station, everybody.
Thanks for having us, Jeff.
So, pirate theme. How did you pick up the pirate theme?
Well, at the end of every season, I ask my student musicians, what kind of music do you want to play next year? How was the season, basically, and what kind of music do you want to play next year? And every once in a while I get things like, well, we'd like to play Beethoven's Seventh, but consistently I want to play Pirates of the Caribbean. So I started from that, and you just heard the Black Pearl, Pirates of the Caribbean, or at least a piece of it, and I just looked through my catalog and saw there's lots of pirates music out there, and so the entire concert turned into a pirates theme.
And what pirate themes are you playing?
We're playing two scores from Pirates of the Caribbean. You just heard a little bit of Black Pearl, and we're also playing the Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End. We're playing a Leroy Anderson tune. Actually, one time we did a whole concert of Leroy Anderson tunes, but Leroy Anderson has a pirate tune called Pirate Dance. And we couldn't do it without Pirates of Penzance from Gilbert and Sullivan. And we're doing Pirate Treasure March, which is it's a treasure in itself. I had no idea how good it was. It's a student work. I don't think you'd hear it. You could find a recording of it. You'll only be able to hear it if you come hear us play. So that's our pirate lineup.
Sounds like a lot of fun. How many people are in the orchestra?
We've got 40. Unless the wind is blowing right, then maybe we'll get 42.
What instruments define a symphony rather than an orchestra?
Well, historically, they started out as a string ensemble. And so the string players think that they're the whole orchestra. But eventually, composers realized that, we can get some more interesting sounds if we throw some woodwinds in here. Then they allowed the French horn to join. And once the French horn joined, then the rest of the brass section eventually joined. And in the last 150 years, close to 200 years, the tradition has also been to include percussion. 20th century and 21st century music includes a lot of percussion. So you're going to hear actually quite a bit of percussion in this particular piece.
And Lillian is in the studio with us. Lillian, can you please tell us the instrument you play and why you chose that instrument?
I play the clarinet, and I started playing for school. And someone demonstrated the instrument to me, and I just really enjoyed the sound.
And Jaden, how about you? What instrument do you play?
I play the violin, and it kind of appealed to me when I first heard of violin, because my mom and dad were thinking about getting me into a class with Lisa Miles. And I got in there, and I was going to decide whether I liked it or not, and it turned out I liked it, so I stuck with violin.
Dugan, how about you?
Well, when I was little, I liked the sound more than I liked a couple other instruments that were in my family, like the guitar, the mandolin, and piano. And I chose that from the four of them.
And what instrument do you play?
Violin.
What's the most fun about being in the symphony orchestra?
Well, it's from all ages, from Teza, who is
eight
mm-hmm. to 80 years old.
Jaden, how about you? What's the most fun for you about being in the orchestra?
I really like just the music we play, and especially I'm really familiar with this music, so it's not necessarily easy for me to play because I started kind of late, but I'm starting to get the hang of it, and it's just really nice.
And Julian, how about you? What's your favorite part about playing in the orchestra?
Well, at first I was just playing for school, so I didn't get to play much. And then I heard about the Juno Student Symphony, and I really wanted to play. And I think it's really cool, just the sound of so many different instruments playing so many different parts.
Rick, what differentiates a movie score than from a more of a classical work?
I really don't think there's any differentiation. There are some things that are you're more likely to hear. Of course, some movie directors and writers put regular classical music in as their movie scores. I'm thinking of Green Card, and I mean, there's a gazillion examples, but I don't know, Green Card and Mozart's Clarinet Concerto, slow movement is an example. But I think that movie music is very vivid. It has to complement the action that's going on. And John Williams is a very famous movie score writer, and I've seen people, or I've read people writing about him saying that what he does is he develops little themes that represent either certain actions or more often certain characters called leitmotifs. And so I think you see that, you hear that a lot in movie music. I think that's part of the pleasure of playing it, that my students have already mentioned today, they kind of already know it, and they're in a way they're playing the movie, and all of these scenes and visuals from the movie pop up. We're not so much a hearing being, we're a visual being, and so when we can connect that visual part of our brain through hearing, I think that's just, it's really pleasurable, really fun.
And when you give directions to your symphony members, do you do it in a pirate voice?
Hi. In fact, there is one part where everybody has to sing. And they were singing like angels, and I said, I think this is a pirate song. You ought to be singing like pirates. And they got a little more lusty after that. I was very happy to hear.
I'm talking to Rick Trostel, Jaden, and Jillian, and Dugan about the Pirates themed symphony, the Juno Symphony program here for tomorrow. Starts at noon in the State Office Building and then goes on at 7 o'clock at the Zach Gordon Youth Center. That's an interesting place for a concert, the Zach Gordon Youth Center.
Yeah, it's you wouldn't think of that as a concert venue, but I guess I've always got these things running in the back of my mind, and I was walking home one day by the bridge by the governor's mansion, and I looked down, it was early evening, and there was this bright neon glow coming from towards the Zach Gordon Youth Center, and I realized, oh, that's the new covered basketball area. And a few days later, I went down and I tested the acoustics, singing and clapping and banging around. And I thought, this would be a nice venue to play in. It's pretty much outdoors, but it's well covered. We'll have a fire going in the fire pit. So you can bring marshmallows and roast marshmallows while you're listening to really fun music.
Are costumes encouraged?
Costumes are encouraged. I didn't have to mention anything, and the orchestra decided, we'll leave it for a little something for your imagination, and you can come see what we come up with.
Sounds good, and that's happening tomorrow at the State Office Building Atrium at noon, and also at 7 o'clock at the Zach Gordon Youth Center covered basketball area, the Juno Student Symphony. It's pay-as-you-can performance. Tickets are available at the door like usual, right?
Yep, it's actually pay-as-you-can.
All right. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Just thank you, Jeff, for all you do for our community and for helping us get our word out.
And thank you for being such great performers.
Thanks.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 18th of August, 2011. It's the birthday of the French virologist Luc Montagnier, born 1932 near Tours. Got interested in science when he was very young because of his father, who was an amateur scientist. In the 60s and 70s, he got interested in a possible link between retroviruses and cancer. And when the AIDS epidemic hit in the early 80s, Dr. Montagnier applied his retrovirus research to a search for the cause of the syndrome and isolated a virus that was present in patients with a pre-AIDS condition of persistent swollen lymph nodes. They call it LAV, lymphadenopathy-associated virus, later renamed HIV, human immunodeficiency virus. And once they'd isolated the virus, they could develop a test for it. Luc Montagnier and his colleagues were awarded the Nobel Prize in 2008. It was on this day, 1958, Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita was published in the United States. It had come out in France 3 years before by a publisher that specialized in erotica. The story of a middle-aged man, Humbert Humbert, and his obsession with his landlady's 12-year-old daughter. Graham Greene loved it. E.M. Forster, Evelyn Waugh, Edmund Wilson did not. In a postscript, Nabokov wrote, "Once or twice I was on the point of burning the unfinished draft when I was stopped by the thought that the ghost of the destroyed book would haunt my files for the rest of my life." And it was on this date in 1920, the 19th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified, giving women the right to vote. The women's suffrage movement arose in the 19th century hand in hand with the abolitionist movement. 1848, Women's Rights Convention, Seneca Falls, New York, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott. And in the latter half of the 19th century, gradually states began loosening restrictions on voting rights for women. Wyoming, the first state to grant women the full right to vote, 1890. 1919, the constitutional amendment passed. Both houses of Congress was sent to the states for ratification, and on August 18, 1920, it all came down to Tennessee. The legislature tied 48-48, and it all came down to one person, Harry Byrne, 24 years old, the youngest state legislator, who had been expected to vote against it, but his mother wrote him a note and said, "Be a good boy and help Mrs. Catt put the rat in ratification," and he voted yes. Here's a poem for today by Mae Swenson, entitled Running on the Shore. The sun is hot, the ocean cool, the waves throw down their snowy heads. I run under their hiss and boom, mine their wild breath, running the ledge where pipers prod their awls into sand crab holes. My barefoot tracks, their little prints cross the wet slate. Circles of romping water, swipe and drag away our evidence, running and gone, the casts of our feet. My twin, my sprinting shadow, on yellow shag, wand of summer over my head, it seems that we could run forever while the strong waves crash. But sun takes its belly under, flashing above magnetic peaks of the ocean's purple heave, the gannet climbs and turns to a black sword that drops hilt down to the deep. Running on the Shore by Mae Swenson from Nature, Poems Old and New, published by Mariner, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine. You can read the current issue of Poetry or listen to the monthly editor's podcast at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Kathy Roach and Nick Vetter. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Time is 3:21 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guests are Sarah Nemi and Amelia Jenkins here to talk about the thing that's going on this Saturday at the Valley Library, 39 Clues. Thank you very much for coming to the station, Sarah and Amelia.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So first of all, 39 Clues, what does that all mean?
The 39 Clues is a series of adventure books, and in it the two main characters kind of go on an international clue hunt for 39 clues. And they kind of have to collect the clues before various other members of their family does. And the ones who collect all 39 clues will supposedly win a great deal of power.
That's cool.
But as long as they're popular, they keep making more books. So we'll see what happens.
Yes. And what's going to be happening Saturday at 1 o'clock at the Valley Library?
On Saturday at 1 o'clock, we are having a much smaller version. Instead of a global treasure hunt, we are having a library-wide treasure hunt. Kids will be divided into three teams, and they'll be given one clue that they'll have to figure out and find, and that clue will lead them to another clue, and each team will have 13 clues, which adds up to 39.
What age is this for?
It's aimed primarily at around 8 to around 12. But anyone younger or older is welcome to attend.
What kind of clues do you want to give out now?
Well, we don't want to give anything away, but some of the clues will be different sections of the library that kids, they'll also be given a map to help them learn the different sections of the library, and the clues will draw them into new areas. Some will be tucked into books. Some they'll have to figure out a number puzzle to get the number, the call number, for where the next clue will be hidden.
How long of an activity is this?
I'm guessing the scavenger hunt itself will take about 40 minutes, and then there'll be some snacks and visiting, maybe book browsing, tuck in around it.
What do you think accounts for the success of the 39 Clues book series?
The authors is part of it. Each book, each installation is written by a different, very successful children's writer. So that's drawn a lot of attention. And the website, too.
It's something that Scholastic actually put together. They had all the authors write. And they have a website that you can kind of join the 39 clues and do your own scavenger hunt as if you were a character in the book.
So you're both the children's librarians. What's the most fun thing about being a children's librarian?
All of it. The children. And the books.
I love story times and toddler times, and we get to dance the hokey pokey with all these amazing little children and have a ball and get paid for it. It's, what better job could you have just to have fun with children?
Sure, a favorite kind of story that you've been telling over the years that seems to draw the attention of and imagination of young people?
Well, the very young always like anything they can make sound effects with.
I'm thinking bodily sound effects.
Sure, or animal noises.
Oh, cool.
Sure. Older kids like ones where they can anticipate what's going to happen, like three-act structure, and they know that the same thing is going to happen to the second brother that happened to the first, and they start finishing sentences, and that's very satisfying for them.
So repetition is good.
Repetition is good.
So story time and teller time on a break for a little while, but they'll be back on mid-September?
We are. At the beginning of September, we'll be back to the full schedule, story time and toddler time, at all three public libraries.
Sounds great, Amelia Jenkins and Sarah Nemi. Is there anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
Thanks for having us, Amelia.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to the next event.
If people need more information about the 39 clues, how can they do that?
Juno.org/library or 586-5249 for this or any other library events.
And Sarah and Amelia, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thank you
for having us.
Have fun with your clues.
Thank you.
Everyone knows getting a job is a surefire way to put cash in your pocket and pay the bills, but what if you're still in high school? With Homebridge, you can stay at school and get to work, and you can get high school and college credit at the same time. Learn at your own pace without the distraction of a classroom. And with Homebridge, you can still be a part of school dances and sports events. Get the money you want and the education you need. Call Homebridge at 209-HOME.
Time is 3:27, and you are tuned in to KTOO News in Juneau. The second half of a Juneau afternoon today is dedicated to a conversation with NPR correspondent Peter Kenyon. Coastal Alaska News Director Ed Schoenfeld is now in the KTOO TV studio downstairs with Peter and the tour in front of a live audience. We go to Ed now.
Peter Kenyon here with a group of active, interested Juneau residents and a few visitors. Ed Schoenfeld, talking to him. Peter, you've been to parts of the world that some of us couldn't even find on the map, but you started here in Southeast Alaska. How in the world did that happen?
Well, that was in Petersburg, just south of here. I walked up the steps to the old gym above the high school, above the old gym on the high school, and Bill Legere was the news director. He looked much the same. The friend I had come up with ran off to go do her music show, and I was just standing there, and Katie Sloan, the program director, came marching up to me and said, "You know classical music?" And I said, "Beethoven?" She said, "Good, show up Sunday morning at 9:30, you're our new classical music host." So that was my very first job in public radio. I didn't get paid for that one, but eventually moved on to news.
So there is a story, which apparently is a myth, that you started it. KFSK in Petersburg because they had a shower and you were living someplace without a shower.
I was living someplace without a shower. I was very happy that the new K2 building, you know, as many public radio stations did, they moved into the old Assembly of God building, and that building had a shower, and the community in Petersburg was up very early, and by 6:30 in the morning they were happy to listen to Radio Reader, as I recall, which was a half-hour show, so you could put that on and go take a quick shower and be back on the job.
That bathroom has since been remodeled, but a few people there still call it the Peter Kenyon shower. What was your first story?
My first story, there was a guy in town whose son had married a woman from El Salvador, This would have been late 81, early 82, I think. So I packed up this big, bulky cassette player and found a microphone and went down to their house and sat her down, very nervous young woman in the living room, and talked to her about San Salvador, what it was like with Dawison and the death squads, and members of her family had been kidnapped, and tanks in the streets. And then I just stayed up all night in the station trying to figure out how to cut the tape and put it into a radio story. And so I guess my first story was a foreign story after all, but followed by years of fish reporting.
And what is the price of salmon in Istanbul?
Yes, too high, and it's all farmed, so I wouldn't recommend it.
Well, as has been said, you're currently based in Istanbul, Turkey. How do you define your beat, or how do your employers define your beat there?
Well, this year, your beat is go where we need you. I mean, it's just been such a crazy year in the Middle East. The idea was that I would have this strangely bifurcated beat where I would live in Turkey. My main focus would be Iran and the nuclear question and just Iranian politics in general. And also Persian Gulf Oil, as the half of NPR foreign people wanted me to move to Dubai, and the other half were holding out for Istanbul. And fortunately, Istanbul won out. But I got about a month and a half of that this year, and then all of a sudden, just everything just broke loose. And it's been, you know, Cairo, Libya, Bahrain, Syria, Lebanon. So, yeah, I am supposed to be paying a lot more attention to Iran, but it's just hard to come up for air.
Mm-hmm. I just read an article in one of the American journalism publications that focused on why there are so many journalists in Istanbul, particularly freelancers. You were mentioned in there. Somebody gave you a hug, the author, I believe.
That was nice.
Why is Istanbul so much of a center of foreign journalist activity?
Well, these things kind of go in cycles. I mean, years ago it was Cairo, and then for a while it was Lebanon, especially when the Iraq invasion happened, because there was a flight from Beirut to Baghdad, and reporters coming out of Baghdad would land in Beirut and find out what a great city it is, and next thing you know, they're living there as their base. But I think there's a little bit of that to Istanbul, too. It's just a fabulous city, I mean, with the history and great food, and you can live there quite cheaply if you're a freelancer, if you hunt around in some of the older neighborhoods. And there's terrific connections to everywhere. Photographers especially love it. A lot of the National Geographic people and some other very good photographers hang out there.
So easy flights from there to other key parts of the region?
Yeah. I mean, and I suspect, I mean, my rank speculation is one of many reasons why the EU isn't quite sure it wants to let the Turkish people into the club, because it is such an open gateway to the whole rest of the region.
For those just tuning in on K2 News, you're listening to an interview with Peter Kenyon on Juno Afternoon, NPR correspondent based in Istanbul. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, and we have an audience here who will be asking questions shortly. You, of course, covered the Alaska legislature and statewide issues, then hosted Alaska News Nightly after your work in Petersburg. There isn't a whole lot of danger in Alaska reporting. I was shot at once, but it was just a kid out there trying out his gun and not realizing where people were. Occasionally, you'll get a longliner who will get mad about a story you did on charter halibut fishing.
And that can be dangerous.
They'll threaten to come after you with a gaff hook, but usually you buy them a beer and it's okay. But you're in the middle of areas with wars, revolutions, border skirmishes, all sorts of things. How do you keep yourself safe?
Well, there's a few rules that you have to follow. You know, of course, the obvious one being, you know, there's two sides, don't get in between them. That's not always so easy. Iraq was particularly hard because you just didn't know where it was coming from. And there were five or six different kinds of conflict going on at the same time. You know, there was old regime types trying to get revenge. There were people trying to destroy evidence. There were Sunnis going after Shiites and vice versa, and the Kurds were in the mix. It was that was very dangerous around 2004, 2005, and 2006 especially. And sometimes Libya got to be that way as well. You couldn't tell where the front was. It would just, but that was a little more stable. That was moving up and down the road. It's a highway war. There's this coastal road that goes, you know, from Benghazi all the way around through Ajdabiya and the oil ports into Sirte, which is the Gaddafi stronghold, and then on up to Tripoli. And the war was pretty much right on that, you know, two-lane blacktop all the way along. So you could sort of follow it back and forth, but you could still get caught because after a while the NATO bombers were hitting the tanks, and so the Gaddafi forces stopped using the tanks. They got in the same white pickup trucks that the rebels were using, and they were just coming like this, and it was very difficult to figure out where you were. I believe that's what happened to Anthony Shadid and Tyler and the four New York Times people who were detained for a while. They just got caught, and they thought they were with the rebels, and it turns out they weren't.
Has that ever happened to you where you're maybe not something that particularly dangerous, but where you thought you were with people from one side and it turned out they were not?
I've been pretty lucky in that, but I have been in situations where where it changed very, very rapidly, where you were, you know, where you thought you were, and then but the assumptions that made you think that was safe suddenly vanished, you know, under your feet. So there's, you know, certain scrambling that has to go on.
You had mentioned when we were chatting earlier that Yemen was a particularly interesting place to be working as a reporter. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yemen, I mean, their national slogan should be a wonderful place to be kidnapped. That's actually a real story. There was a bunch of Italian tourists who were kidnapped by a tribe who were trying to agitate for more jobs for their tribe with the government. So they held these people for 2 weeks, and they got out, and the woman said, "That was the best vacation I ever had. The food was lovely. They were so nice." But it really is an amazing country. I mean, the houses, they just sort of come straight up. These clay houses come up out of the mountain rocks like they were just growing out of it, this beautiful sort of gingerbread design on the outside. And the people are just really exotic and dramatic, you know. Guys in skirts with daggers phallically positioned and, you know, colorful dress and charming old habits. They also tend to chew a lot of cot, unfortunately. Some mild weed that they just leaves that you chew on all afternoon, and it makes you kind of lazy. But, yeah, it's a beautiful, charming, and desperately screwed-up country. They're almost out of water. There's at least two rebellions going on at any given time, and that was before the uprising, and now their president is threatening to come back, and nobody really wants that. But, Yemen, if it ever comes down, I strongly advise a visit. It's just a beautiful, beautiful place.
As you have bounced around northern Africa and the Mideast and the Persian Gulf, and I'm sure it doesn't feel that way, but from our perspective, you'll turn on the radio and, where's Peter reporting from today? Is that gunfire in the background? I wonder, how do you adjust to the new situations? How do you, you know, you find yourself in a particular country and it's different from the last country you were in and the last country, and yet it may all blur together. How do you prepare for that? How do you adjust to the different places and cultures?
Well, I mean, one of the exciting things, the really fun things about this, you know, working in a strange part of the world with such a lot of history is the learning curve. You just have to immerse yourself in so many different cultures and historical events that it's really fascinating. But in terms of preparation, you really need to have a good, we call them fixers, translator, interpreter on the ground, someone who is often a journalist, but not always, but someone who can convey to you in a very short space of time, you know, what's going on and who the players are and how you deal with the issues in their country. And I've been very lucky to find some excellent people out there. It's a tough job working with a lot of stressed out foreign correspondents, but the good ones are real keepers.
Now, you left Alaska in 1995?
That's right, 95, went to D.C., yeah.
For D.C. and covered Congress, and then you've been overseas for quite a while. Looking back at what's going on here, you still maintain contacts and a home here. Mm. How does Alaska look from the perspective of the Middle East or Turkey?
Well, I mean, personally, I miss it. I miss it a lot. It's great to be back in a place where August weather means you have to wear a sweater and sunny days are prized and greatly appreciated. I think I used to enjoy, in a sense, the anonymity of it. I could talk to people and they'd say, where are you from? I'd say, oh, I'm from Alaska, and then you get a blank stare. You know. But then after a couple of years ago, that all stopped, and now they all say, oh, Sarah Palin. Oh, what do you think of Sarah Palin? So Alaska's becoming more and more known. I don't know if people would say for the right reasons, but it's definitely becoming more known.
Now, I remember you covering when you worked here in the Capitol, I believe, deterioration of the Alaska pipeline, and mm-hmm. of course we still have those issues. Things don't stop deteriorating. Do you ever look at that or any of the sort of issues you covered way back then, see that they're still up, and you know, the gas line, how long have we been talking about that, and think, I've been there before, it's exactly the same thing, or do you have a different perspective?
Well, let me say, you're looking pretty good. You're holding up pretty well. But yeah, I think I was spoiled covering political issues in Alaska because it's just so much smaller and easier to understand, and there's less, although it doesn't seem like it when you're here, believe me, when you get out to Washington, the difference is amazing. I feel pretty lucky that I got to learn the trade here, especially compared to Washington, which is sort of the same thing except with a lot more BS involved.
Mm-hmm. Well, about time to take some questions from the audience here. So if anybody here would like to ask questions, come on over to the microphone. I'd like to remind our listeners that on Juno afternoon, this afternoon, we're having a little bit of a special program. NPR reporter Peter Kenyon, based in Istanbul now, is with us. I'm Ed Schoenfeld hosting. And first question, introduce yourself and ask your question.
My name is Ron Clark. How do you find a good fixer? How do you find a translator? And then how do you monitor what they're saying? How do you know they're really conveying the things you want them to accurately?
That's a good question, and it's a key part of the job. You live or die on the quality of your interpreter in a lot of ways, especially when you don't understand the language. And I did study Arabic for a while, but I'm not confident enough yet to use it on my own. And you can find perfectly well-meaning translators who can help putting their own spin on things. You know, they want this person to sound a certain way, not to sound stupid, for instance, not to sound radical. And they will sometimes try to smooth out the edges. In one obvious instance, when I was in the West Bank many times, especially after I had picked up a little bit of Arabic, I could hear this. The person I was interviewing would go, la, 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 Yahud, la, 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 meaning the Jews did this, the Jews did that. And then the translator would come on and say, oh, the Israelis did this and the Israelis did that. You know, it's a small difference, but I realized that, you know, the person I was interviewing meant to say the Jews because that's the way they thought, and that's what they, you know, and that's what I wanted to get on the air, not the sort of diplomatic version of it. So there's issues like that. And the good ones, I still have a terrific translator in Beirut, and in Libya we were very lucky with translators, and a terrific translator in Egypt. They're just, they're great.
Hi, I'm Sherry Williams, and I wonder I'm certain you've met many interesting leaders. I wonder who they are, and did anyone surprise you with their personality or turn out to be different than you conceived them to be?
Well, we did manage to interview Bashar al-Assad a few years ago. We were the foreign desk of NPR. There's a group of us, 12 or 15 of us, who wound up covering Iraq quite heavily for many years. And as a reward / planning session, we would have a meeting somewhere in the area every year to plot out who was going to go when and what the coverage issues were, what the safety issues were. And one year we said, well, why not go to Damascus? It's a neighboring country. And so they were under heavy sanctions at the time and feeling very isolated. And so we called them up and they said, oh, great, come on. You want to interview the president? Yeah, so we said, okay, sure. And we went to the palace and there he was. And he's very tall, kind of very expressive, moves his hands a lot like this. It's good radio technique here. But, he had a wonderful line and excellent English. You know, he trained as an ophthalmologist in England, so his English is excellent. and talked a wonderful game, none of which ever came true, of course. But and we're actually seeing that now, claiming that the military operations are over and that it's all dialogue, but unfortunately the bodies still keep piling up. But he was an interesting character.
Another question from the audience.
Peter, good to have you here. My name is Wade Rogers. Sort of had a question about some of the recent things that we've seen, revolts in Egypt and Libya and even in Iran and places like that. My sense of it is that there's sort of an undercurrent with a lot of younger people sort of trying to throw off these older entrenched regimes. I guess my question is, with the proliferation of technology, like cell phones and the internet, what sort of role does that play in world politics that way?
Well, it's a much bigger role than anyone anticipated, and the governments, the regimes, are really struggling to deal with it now. One story, this didn't happen to me, but I've talked to some other journalists who reported this, that people had fled out of Syria into Lebanon when the fighting got bad in Tel Kalak, and about a week or two later they're trying to go back, so they're at the border, and the border guards are checking their cars, and they seize their laptop, and they say, well, checking their suitcase, and just before they go, they say, wait, have you got a Facebook? I go, no, I haven't got one of those. He says, okay, go ahead. So they knew Facebook was bad. They didn't know quite what it was.
Hi, Peter. Peter Freer. To what extent, or how do the foreign nationals and the foreign leaders that you meet with whom you have contact, view the current dysfunction in American politics?
Well, I think it depends on their needs at the moment. There has been quite a bit of talk that Prime Minister Netanyahu was pleased with the dysfunction because he didn't seem to be getting along that well with Obama. And then other people like Mubarak, who just, he was Mr. Steady, we have a deal. I promise I'm not going to make war with Israel, and you keep the money flowing, $2 billion a year and lots of weapons. I think the people who like to make the most of it would be probably the Iranians. They're always on the lookout for propaganda ammunition, and you see a lot of comments in the Iranian press. They give heavy play to the infighting and the feuding in Congress, which is, in part, I think, meant as a distraction to their own infighting. I mean, Ahmadinejad is under heavy fire from the Supreme Leader and his allies. It's a fairly opaque system. I'm not sure I could actually explain who's in charge, but he has been accused of being a witch and a sorcerer, and it gets a little bizarre. But, they're having a lot of troubles there, and the more you can point to external conflicts and see how bad it is over there, that goes on a lot.
Hi, my name is Patty Ware, and I wonder if you could share any thoughts on Morocco. It's got a young population, relatively high unemployment rate, but it's been pretty stable, and I guess I'm interested in your perspective on that.
One of the newest members of the Gulf Cooperation Council. That's the Persian Gulf, six countries. It used to be, now it's eight, and they took in Jordan and Morocco, neither of which is anywhere near the Gulf. But they're both monarchies that are relatively stable in very troubled times. I'm a big fan of Morocco. I like it quite a bit. I would have been there more in my time in Egypt, except my boss used to live there too, and he knew how nice it was, and he thought I was just trying to get a vacation. The king there is relatively well-liked. I mean, there's problems in the south towards the Western Sahara area, but he has just announced some new reforms, which, while probably inadequate in the end, are a big step forward. And economically, Morocco could be poised to be booming, really. I mean, they're finishing up the largest port in Africa, right up on the corner there by Agadir, and they've got great trade potential with Spain. They already have some. But, it's a lovely country. Unfortunately, there's this problem across all of North Africa. The gap between the haves and the have-nots is huge. And if they could alleviate that and create a bit of a middle class, I think there'd be great potential there.
Another question.
Hi, I'm Mary Alice. I'm really glad you're visiting. I have heard that the issue in Turkey of the denial of the Armenian massacre, I mean, it's an issue in Turkish mm-hmm. politics and society. I know sometimes authors are imprisoned because they refer to it, and it's a crime to refer to it. I would just be interested in your perspective on that. Is it a big deal in Turkey, or is it just something, you know, you read about, and just your whole perspective on that issue?
It is, unfortunately, too big a deal there, and it's often a pawn in the larger struggle between secular Turks and the new elite, or the new growing elite, now that the Islamic government has been in power for 8 years. They have built up a whole new power structure, putting their own people in key positions. The Armenian genocide issue is extremely difficult. The whoever's in charge is forced to take an extremely hard line on it, and it's really unfortunate. There are intellectuals who try to, meet with the other side and try to get past it and try and figure it out, and it's a bit like, you know, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. People can talk about a way to do it. They can outline it on paper. They just can't do it in real life, and I'm not sure where it's going to go. The Kurds are another issue. I think actually they may solve the Kurdish problem before they deal with the Armenian one properly. That border's been closed for over 15 years. I mean, an incredible waste for a country that prides itself on economy and having, as they claim, zero problems with the neighbors. They really could be doing better on this.
Before our next question, I'd like to remind our listeners on Juno Afternoon that Peter Kenyon will be addressing the Juno World Affairs Council at 5 o'clock at the Jack across the street, the Arts and Culture Center here in Juno, talking about North Africa and related issues, so maybe going over some of the material we're talking about now, but in some more depth, and covering some other stuff too. Again, you're listening to a discussion with NPR's Peter Kenyon, and we have another question from the audience.
Hi, my name is Kathy Connor, and I wonder, with the drought and famine in the Horn of Africa right now, what role does drinking water availability play in Middle Eastern politics?
It's very big. It is underlying a lot of the issues across, especially the Levant and, from Turkey on down. It's one of the big issues between Turkey and Syria. It's a huge issue in some ways between the Syrian Israel, Israel and the Palestinians. The Jordanians get in the way there. There's serious problems with the Dead Sea, which isn't drinking water. But there are a number of big, big water problems all over the region. Having lived 6 years in Cairo, they were completely shocked when the downstream users of the Nile got together and said, "We don't like this treaty that says you can have as much as you want, and we have to get we have to limit our use to make sure that you get everything you want." And Egypt now has started to realize that, and Sudan as well. They're going to have to come to the table and negotiate a new deal. Yeah, it's religion, land and power get all the headlines, but water is a really huge issue.
Hi, Peter. I'm Beth Weigel. And I think the last time I saw you in Juneau, you were performing at the Alaska Folk Festival. And yeah. I'm just wondering how maybe you've carried some of your musical traditions into, the countries that you're at, and how you've maybe connected to some of the musical traditions there, and any other window into the arts that you've explored while abroad.
Sadly, the farther I move away from Alaska, the less time I seem to have to play. I try to keep a few calluses going here and there, but it's not easy. I really have enjoyed, when I can, getting a chance to do some art stories and music stories especially. One of my favorites, I think, was a story I did in Algeria of Shabi music. Shabi music over in Morocco is more of a dance, they call it rye music there. Sort of a people's dance music, local themes and, broken hearts and getting a job. But in Algeria, it is the remnants of the 15th century Andalusian classical music from Spain. And when they were all kicked out in 1492, that tradition went with them to North Africa. And it was developed in the last century by one man in particular. I got to meet his son and got to hear a concert. Very long songs that go on for like 20, 30 minutes at a time, and lovely old sort of Spanish/African melodies. It's a real treat to get to hear some of that.
Peter. My name is Greg Erickson. I'd like to get your perspective on Al Jazeera, its reliability, how it's changed things, your thoughts about its control by the government of one of those little principalities. Could give us that your perspective on that?
Sure. Al Jazeera was a sea change in Arab media when it launched in Arabic. It was in constant trouble from the get-go. Countries who thought they could just get rid of things they didn't like were threatening the emir of Qatar, and you've got to get rid of this. And the reason, oddly enough, at that time was because they were putting Israeli spokespeople on the air, which was unheard of. And they have gradually, they've spawned competitors, Al Arabiya and other channels, and they've come out with an English language channel. And that has now, with this Arab Spring, started to make inroads even in the U.S. There are more and more cable systems here where you can get it, and you can get it on the Internet. My shorthand impression of Al Jazeera English is that it's almost indistinguishable from CNN International or the BBC. In fact, they use a lot of the same, a lot of old BBC people work for Al Jazeera English now. The main difference being you get a lot more stories from Africa and Latin America. But the content and the tone of the stories is almost identical. Now, the Arabic is a bit more out there, and they sometimes get speakers on there who they just let run on with some rather off-the-wall comments. But the English, I think, is it's been a revelation to people who don't know it, who have only think of Al Jazeera as, you know, the terrorist network. It really, you can get a lot of good information from them.
We have time for one more question.
Hi, Peter. Ben Brown. So how often do you get back to the United States and Alaska? Is it often enough? And when you're done, if you ever are going to be done in the Middle East, is there another region of the world you're looking forward to working on?
Not often enough. That's absolutely the answer. It is an awful long way to come is the problem. And, you know, it's more or less 2 days to get here. And but I always, and once I get there, you know, we live in Petersburg is where our land is. And you get there and the time frame just snaps into place, and the next thing you know, the whole week is gone. You know, you think 2 weeks is a long time, but you forgot about the weather and getting weathered in places, and all of a sudden it's over. So, yeah, not often enough. And Alaska is the only place we have property, and I do hope to come back here. Very next thing after the Middle East, I don't know. I'm now sort of 1 foot in Europe and 1 foot in the Middle East, but a lot of it depends on what happens.
A quick question to wrap this up. You've been in places that most of us haven't been in and have seen conflicts and talked to leaders that we never get to talk to or things we never get to see. Has this made you more of an optimist or a pessimist about the future of the world?
I don't know that it's changed that way, but it's given me an appreciation for perspectives that aren't American. Americans tend to be optimistic and think there's solutions to problems, whereas when you go to the Middle East, people are very quick to tell you, you know, look, here's a problem. It has no solution, and that's just the way it is. And then they live with that, and they are in a way they're sort of perversely proud of it. But I believe it's the origin of the scorpion and the frog joke. The punchline I always learned was, you know, why did you sting me? Now we're both going to die because it's my nature. The original punchline I'm told by my Middle Eastern friends is, no, this is the Middle East.
And on that note, we'll wrap this up. You've been listening to a discussion with Peter Kenyon of National Public Radio, originally of Southeast Alaska. Started his work at KFSK in Petersburg, worked for the Alaska Public Radio Network in Juneau and Anchorage, and then went on to Washington, D.C., worked for NPR, and has been wandering around fascinating and conflicted parts of the world ever since. Peter, we'd like to thank you for coming here. We'd like to thank our audience, and remind everyone that at 5 o'clock this evening, which isn't too long from now, over at the the Juneau World Affairs Council, will host Peter talking again and in more depth about Northern Africa. Thanks to the Juneau Afternoon audience for listening, and thanks to you, Peter, for coming.
Thanks, Ed.
And you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTUO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Off Bay area, tuned to K276AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201AM 88.1, K220BT Sarsuna at 91.9. Next, scooting inland on Icy Street, you can hear KTUO on K210AS 89.9. Also online at www.ktuo.org. With a forecast for tonight, a chance of showers in the evening and rain likely later on, low temperatures around 50 degrees. Forecast for Friday looks like rain with high temperatures around 57 degrees.